This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
China is already moving towards economic ascendancy. They are going to be the beating heart of this global economy. And that means that the rest of the world, and I think North America in particular, has to wake up and has to get serious. Otherwise, they're going to eat not just our lunch today, but our breakfast tomorrow morning.
The 16th UN Climate Change Summit, also known as Conference of the Parties or COP16, was just held in Cancun, Mexico. So what happened there? Did we get the agreement we wanted? Many environmentalists say no, but my guests today both believe the summit was nevertheless historical and constructive. Today on Sea Change Radio, we hear from Kate Shepard, an environmental reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, and Martin Chilcott, the CEO of 2Degrees Network. Both attended the summit in Cancun earlier this month and give us their perspectives for the next UN summit in Durban, South Africa, the greening of China, and the potential Sputnik moment that could ignite the United States' competitive spirit and finally inspire bolder climate change policy. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Kate Shepard. She's an environmental reporter for Mother Jones. She's also written for Grist, and she is involved in the Climate Desk project. Kate, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Enjoyed your writing for a long time. You've just gotten back from the summit in Cancun. Can you first give us a recap of what transpired in Copenhagen last year?
Absolutely. So if we look back, you actually need to go back a few more years to a summit in Bali, Indonesia, in which world leaders agreed that they were going to lay out this roadmap, they called it, to coming to a new international binding climate treaty. Of course, we had the Kyoto Protocol, which was the countries came to agreement on back in 1997, but notably the U.S. was not a part of that, and that did not include China, Indonesia, Brazil, some of these other big emerging major emitter countries here. So world leaders recognized that they needed a new agreement that was going to include those countries as well, and so they laid out this pathway that would have led ideally to a new international binding treaty last year in Copenhagen. And there's a lot of expectation built up around Copenhagen that they were going to reach that goal there. But in the weeks shortly before that meeting, they really scaled back their expectations and said, you know, we're probably not going to have a legally binding agreement here. We'll probably have a political agreement, you know, an agreement between countries that doesn't really necessarily have any legal component to it at this point in time. And so when we headed into Copenhagen, already with some scaled back expectations about what would happen there, and in the 2 weeks of that summit, it was really this you know, display of countries kind of facing off on this, particularly the U.S. and China. And, you know, we saw 2 weeks of negotiations where they could really come to agreement on very little. In the final hours of Copenhagen, President Obama and a few leaders from other countries, China, Brazil, India, they came together and basically crafted a basic political agreement that said, here's the things that we agreed to do, but it didn't necessarily really mean anything in the UN process. It was outside of the process, and the 194 countries that do make up the UN couldn't come to agreement on it, and it was never formally adopted. So we had this agreement that said, you know, we're going to limit temperature rise to 2 degrees. Here are the pledges that countries are going to fulfill in the interest of meeting that goal, but it didn't really actually necessarily mean anything. And so heading into Cancun this year, they were looking to at least formalize some of those things they agreed to last year.
So what were the expectations heading into Cancun this year?
Well, so heading into Cancun, there were very, very low expectations for what they would come to agreement on there. The basic tenets that they were looking to achieve were to formalize the commitments that countries made on emissions cuts last year. So the countries would actually inscribe in the UN, you know, processes and say, here's what exact emission cuts that we're going to commit to for the next 10 years or 20 years or, you know, whatever their commitment might be. So that was one thing, was just to formalize those commitments. The second thing that they were looking to accomplish was to formalize the agreement on creating a $100 billion fund to help the most vulnerable countries both cut their own emissions and adapt to changes that are happening already. In Copenhagen, that they made that commitment, but it wasn't formalized, and they really hadn't gone through the hard work of actually setting up that fund and figuring out what it would look like and who would be in charge and all those big questions. And so that was the other expectation in Cancun, was that they would formalize that question. There's also they were looking to move further on some commitments on a program that would reduce emissions from deforestation around the world. And so heading into Cancun, those were basically what they were hoping to accomplish there. And you know, related to that is this big question of transparency and how countries would both show the rest of the world that they're meeting their commitments, and how the rest of the world would be able to actually monitor and verify that countries are doing what they said they would do on climate.
So you mentioned deforestation. We had Rolf Skar on a few weeks ago, who is the Greenpeace representative for deforestation at the summit. Can you tell us what progress was made in terms of RED, and maybe tell us what RED is first?
Well, the basic idea of RED is that you would pay people in countries who have large forests not to chop them down, not to turn them into land for other uses, and not to sell off the their forests, you know, for logging.
So it tries to create a financial value for the carbon that's stored in trees, right?
Exactly. And so rather than cutting them down, people would be paid to keep them intact and keep them, cutting carbon from our atmosphere. So what they did agree to here was basically the formalization of a mechanism to do that, so that developed countries could help pay developing countries not to go forward on deforestation, which has been happening rapidly around the world and which is responsible for, you know, at least 17% of our emissions. And so this was, you know, formalizing this process was, I think, another really important outcome, but they still left a lot of, you know, big questions. I mean, people were pretty nervous about some of these components of RED, about how you make sure that people's rights are protected and how you make sure that, that they're actually following through and doing what they say they're doing when we provide money to avoid this deforestation. And so there still are a lot of questions about how this program would actually work in practice and how you can best ensure that it does work. But at least they did formalize that process and it's moving forward. And it's really important because there are already a lot of programs like this around the world that are in place. And so this is kind of creating international standards for what that would look like.
You mentioned that the Copenhagen summit had a lot of passion surrounding it, and the expectations were a lot higher. Do you think that the lower expectations and the lower passions that were surrounding this most recent summit in Cancun led to a more productive summit, or do you think it was just everyone's expectations were a lot lower?
I think both those things are probably true. Expectations were certainly lower going into Cancun. What people even were hoping would be accomplished was basically the bare minimum of following through and making formal what they agreed to politically last year within the UN process. So there were very, very low expectations, and there was certainly much less hype surrounding it. And I think that almost probably helped the process somewhat. You know, there weren't these, you know, enormous expectations built up, and there wasn't nearly as much, I think, maybe pressure or activity on a lot of the negotiators there. So I think that might actually have helped in achieving, you know, this general consensus around the document that they were able to draft up there.
There were really no heads of state that bothered to attend Cancun. Do you think that's a sign that it's not a priority, or do you think that actually helped the process and that there were more diplomats and people who are really involved in the nuts and bolts of crafting true policy rather than people who are looking for photo ops?
I think that that's absolutely the case. I think it actually helped that this was not nearly the kind of high-level summit that it was last year. I mean, in Copenhagen, I think it was great that we had world leaders coming together and saying that this is an important issue. It's so important that we think it needs to be addressed at the highest levels of government. But when it comes down to hashing out the details of an agreement, I think that's probably that happens a little bit easier when you're doing this, you know, with negotiators, with people who are working on this, you know, in a diplomatic way that necessarily don't have the same kind of outsized personalities as one might see when you're working with the heads of state from around the world. So I think that actually facilitated some probably better dialogue in Cancun than we saw last year.
Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight, or say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short, and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Kate Shepherd, environmental reporter for Mother Jones. Kate, what's the future of the Kyoto Protocol that we've heard about for so long on the heels of Cancun?
Well, I think this is absolutely the most important question coming out of Cancun. Kyoto was signed into law. These countries, you know, they agreed to this, in 1997, and most industrialized countries of the world are part of this. Every country, basically, but the U.S. We created this other process within the UN to create a new deal that would include the US and China, but meanwhile Kyoto continues and countries of the world are bound to Kyoto, but its first commitment period is set to expire at the end of 2012. And there's been this major debate about whether to commit to a second commitment period for Kyoto. Countries, particularly developing countries, are really firm that they want to see a second commitment period for Kyoto because we still have not really gotten a great sense of when or even if this other deal is going to be legally binding, whereas Kyoto is legally binding and it holds countries to their pledges on emissions, and it also creates some of these mechanisms formally that will help provide funding to developing countries. Not nearly enough funding, but at least has those mechanisms in place. So developing countries have insisted that they want to see Kyoto continued after 2012, so that they know that they have something firm there to protect them, basically. There's a number of developed countries who have come out and said that they don't want to have a second commitment period on Kyoto because they don't want to see action on this issue without U.S. and China.
And most surprisingly was Japan, which obviously it's got Kyoto, Japan, right in the name of the Kyoto Protocol. So can you tell us a little bit more about what the Japanese reversal was all about?
It's absolutely, it's pretty strikingly ironic that Japan would choose to walk away from a treaty that bears the name of a city in their country, but it's absolutely what Japan was arguing in Cancun. Japan's basic argument is that Kyoto Protocol only covers about 27% of the world's emissions, and there's still this huge portion that's not included there. Specifically, the U.S. is not included, China is not included, Brazil, Indonesia, these large emerging emitters. Their emissions are increasing, and Japan basically says, well, why should we agree to something that doesn't include those countries at this point in time? And so they've said that they don't want a second commitment period on Kyoto. They would like, this new international deal, and they would like this new international deal to be legally binding as well. But that's really the kind of the rub there. We don't really know when this other deal or if this other deal is going to be legally binding anytime soon. And so developing countries are afraid that if Kyoto dies, they'll have no international legally binding agreement. And it's not just Japan who's saying that they'd like to walk away from Kyoto. Russia also in Cancun said that they were not going to commit to a second commitment period. Canada's been less than enthusiastic about it. And the EU, which has traditionally been one of the biggest supporters of Kyoto, was very insistent in saying that they didn't think a second commitment period made sense if there was not another legally binding agreement that was coming anytime soon that included U.S. and China.
And what's the hope for some other, if it's not called the Kyoto Protocol, will there be a future legally binding document coming from the UN fairly soon, or is this something that now hangs in the balance?
It really, I think, is in the balance now. They didn't solve the question of what to do about Kyoto and Cancun. They basically delayed decision on that until next year, which is creeping somewhat frighteningly close to the expiration of the first commitment period in 2012. And so they left this really hard question to the last minute. And at the same time, there's still no real sense of if or when this other agreement is going to be legally binding. Right now, it's a political agreement between countries, but but it's not legally binding within the UN process. Whether the U.S. will ratify a treaty is really in question. You need 67 senators to ratify a treaty in the U.S., and we can't even pass the domestic climate law at this point in time. So other world leaders are probably justifiably concerned that the U.S. is never going to formally sign onto a treaty. So what does that mean for the future of a global UN or a global climate pact? It's still really not clear.
Tell us about the Green Climate Fund, Kate. It sounds like a good idea, but do you think it'll help move things in the right direction?
The Green Climate Fund, I think it has the potential to move things in the right direction, but like a lot of things that were agreed to in Cancun, there are still some really big important questions as well. So they formalized this agreement to create a $100 billion fund by 2020 that will help developing countries not only cut their own emissions, but adapt to changes that are underway. And so they've created this blueprint for a green fund, but they haven't really figured out where exactly all that money's coming from, how it would go into the fund. It seems like it's probably not going to come from public funds given the current economic situations of a lot of even the developed countries right now. And so is that money going to come from some new international fee on things like shipping and aviation, or is it going to come, through cutting subsidies for fossil fuels? Some of the proposals that have been floated included multinational banks and loans, which is kind of contrary to the idea of the fund, which is supposed to be it's grants rather than loans, but that's an idea that's also been thrown out there. And so,
and it's going to be implemented by the World Bank as well, right?
The World Bank right now is the interim trustee for 3 years, but that is also a considerable cause of, I think, some friction. Developing countries are not as enthusiastic about that as countries like the U.S. are, and that'll be a point of contention going forward as well, I think. So there are a lot of these big, important questions about practically getting that money through this fund to the countries that need it most that we'll have to figure out here, in the next few years, because the idea is that they have that $100 billion mobilized by 2020, but that money will start going through it sooner than that.
For our listeners who don't know about some of the criticisms that have been levied at the World Bank.
Well, and there are a few major criticisms. One is that the World Bank is heavily invested in fossil fuel infrastructure. Even very recently, or earlier this year, they approved a very large loan to build a very large coal plant in South Africa. And so people have questions about whether the World Bank is qualified to run a fund that is supposed to be investing in green investment and things that aren't this fossil fuel infrastructure. And then there's this larger question about, are we looking at loans or that countries will be expected to pay back, or are we looking at grants? Are we looking at, providing direct funding to help countries who didn't cause this problem mitigate and adapt to it? And so people are nervous about, whether the bank would want to see that in the form of loans rather than in the form of grants.
Speaking of South Africa, that's the next summit next year in Durban, South Africa. You wrote that the Mexican organizers behind the Cancun summit that just occurred were able to restore faith in the process. What do you think this spells for Durban?
Well, I think what became clear in Cancun is that the organizers are very important. There was a lot of criticism of the Danish leadership in Copenhagen, and people just were not comfortable with the process. They felt like certain countries were left out of it. They felt like they didn't have a seat at the table. And in Mexico, everybody felt like they very much had a voice and they very much were being heard. The Mexican presidency of the COP was doing its best to attend to everybody's needs and to come out with a final text of an agreement that really made everybody happy. So that, who's in charge is very important. I think that became absolutely clear in Cancun. I'm not going to pass any judgments on what to expect on that front in Durban yet. We'll have to see how it goes in the next year. But I think that leadership is absolutely crucial to coming out with any kind of agreement.
Kate Shepard, environmental reporter for Mother Jones, thanks so much for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Just left home this morning. This old road keeps rolling on and on. Rolling down, something about it. Oh, baby.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is Martin Chilcott. He is the CEO and founder of 2Degrees, the global community for sustainability. People can find it on 2degreesnetwork.com. Martin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. It's great to be here.
Martin, you just returned from Cancun. Any initial reaction from the conference, and did you come away with it hopeful or a little downtrodden the way people thought of the Copenhagen COP15 last year?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. I remember last year somebody in an interview used the term, are you a good cop or a bad cop? Meaning, do you think this is going to be a good conference of parties or a bad conference of parties? And last year, everybody kept saying, but leading up to it, there was huge expectations. And all the way through it, everybody maintained those expectations, saying it was going to be a good COP. And of course, while things came out of it, lots of countries that had never signed up before signed up to certain emissions reductions targets and so forth. It still wasn't the agreement that we wanted. And there were a number of things that have changed significantly. And the most important thing is China. China is already moving towards economic ascendancy. It's in the ascendancy, and it will be the economic world leader within some decades. And it's on a path and a trajectory to accelerate that because it has just laid out its 12th five-year plan for turning itself into a clean, green, low-carbon economic giant. And when China writes these five-year plans, they're not like, I come from Europe where we make the European Union and European governments are forever saying we're going to do X, Y, Z, and they undershoot the target by quite a lot. So we overclaim and underperform. The Chinese government's history with these five-year plan is to overperform and underclaim. So the claims in this five-year plan, and they really are worth looking at, are extremely ambitious. And they intend, I think, pretty much what California and America did with the Internet revolution, is their intention to do the same with the Green Revolution. They are going to be the beating heart of this global economy. And that means that the rest of the world, and I think North America in particular, has to wake up and has to get serious. Otherwise, they're going to eat not just our lunch today, but our breakfast tomorrow morning. And that's good because it's competition spurs us. And I think we might be heading to what somebody called a Sputnik moment. So if you remember, the Russians got into space first, and then JFK and America signed up to getting to the moon before the Russians did and did it. And I think we've got a kind of green equivalent here because China put forward this five-year plan, which is extraordinarily ambitious, and they will deliver on it.
Well, continuing with that Sputnik parallel, one of the contrasts, I think, between this and the space race is that I think the goals of the space race were a little less clear. It was like, all right, we get up there, what are we going to do? And so it seemed like a very expensive boondoggle, so to speak. The crisis that we all face right now seems a little less fuzzy. And yet now we're seeing maybe a divergence, if we can make a parallel with the Soviet Union from the 50s and China. These are not democratically elected leaders, but they see the writing on the wall.
Absolutely. And then that comes really to the second change, which I think is really key. This time in Copenhagen, the side events. So you've got the main negotiations taking place on this occasion in the Moon Palace, and the observers and the kind of the conversations around them in the Metze. And then around that in Cancun, you've got what they call side events. And the side events this year were dominated by business, absolutely dominated by business. And we're talking about big, big, big brands here, from Coca-Cola to Siemens to Nike to Tesco's to and so on. And they were saying with a single voice, government, sort this out, get a price for carbon because we need it. We are going in the meantime to make the investments that we have to make because we recognize two things. One is that the economics of scarcity and the challenges of having a population heading towards 9 billion and the problems with running out of space into which we can put CO2 equivalents, that is all inevitable and is happening and cannot now be denied by any rational person who kind of accepts science for what it is. And secondly, that the opportunity for growth in this revolution, as in every other economic revolution and the previous three economic revolutions, the opportunity for growth is enormous, and they want to seize that growth. So we've now got business, really big names big employers saying, let's get going up with this. Let's stop hanging around and dithering. And that's what they're saying to government. And what they've got some things internally to do for business, because the business lobby is still dominated by the old carbon incumbent industries. But so, I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I think, is probably a fascinating example of this. So Hannah Jones, who's the chief sustainability officer at Nike, you know, basically stood up and said the U.S. Chamber of Commerce does not represent us on this issue, and they do not represent most of the businesses that we work with. And she then listed off, you know, kind of, you know, the household group of names of fast-moving consumer good and retail names in the U.S. And she said, we have now got to go and tell the trade associations that they've got to stop pandering to the people who are pumping full of money, and they have to represent their members in the right way. Otherwise, we will be leaving. And I think that, so there's a change. Business is getting very serious and very active. And they are now, I think, getting to the point where they recognize that they have to give permission to government to go and negotiate properly and to ignore the nonsense, frankly, the nonsense that is spoken about losing jobs when this is actually a net job gain vision for a better economic world. There will be, obviously, in some industries, jobs lost, just in the way that, you know, when Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, was overtaken by the internet and left behind by Wikipedia, of course, there were people who lost their jobs. But how many more jobs were created than those few that were lost? And so we've got to, business has got a voice now. Business wants to be engaged. Business will give, I think, over the next year or two, permission for government to do what government needs to do. So the third difference from Cancun, from Copenhagen at Cancun, was the power and the evidence that sub-national bodies, so regional governments and cities, are just getting on and doing stuff and making real headway and presenting cases, which is really terribly important, case studies of that it can be done, that we can make progress, we can cut emissions, we can create new jobs. And that evidence is coming through very powerfully. And so we've got a much more bottom-up, if you like, mobilization of business and cities and regions, which we didn't see last year. And whilst it may not play particularly strongly into these negotiations, it certainly will pay next time in when we're in Durban. Hopefully what we'll get out of these talks, and of course they've got to run to the end of the week, hopefully what we'll get out is what people are talking about now is not an all-encompassing agreement, but building blocks. And if we can get a series of building blocks, one around putting a natural capital value on forests in with the red, another one on technology transfer and so forth. So we get a few of these building blocks in place. We can mobilize the voices of business and cities and regional government, give national governments the permissions to do what they know they need to be doing and want to do. Then I think we'll be very well set for Durban and beyond.
My guest has been Martin Chilcott. He's the CEO of 2Degrees. It's a global community for sustainability. Martin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Willie Bobo, Delaney and Bonnie, and the Beatles. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Solar Home Specialists and Invisible Structures, a porous paving company. Go to Sungevity.com and InvisibleStructures.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.